Frederick Ryan is a great and forgotten Irishman. He was born on October the 12th, 1873, to John Ryan, a bookkeeper of 8 Brunswick Place, Dublin, and his wife, Catherine. Fred Ryan was a friend of James Connolly's and a member of the Irish Socialist Republican Party. While still in his 20s, he gave talks to members of this party on economic subjects. He was a friend of F.J. Fay, whom he helped found the National Theatre, of which Ryan became the first secretary. He also wrote a play, The Laying of the Foundations. In 1904, with John Eglinton, he established Dana, a monthly review, and as joint editors, they have the embarrassing distinction of rejecting for publication a section of James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. The actual rejecter seems to have been Eglinton. Fred Ryan was a socialist, a rationalist, a feminist, a democratic nationalist, and an internationalist. He was a humanist who believed in the intrinsic goodness of man, and he hated suffering and oppression of all kinds. Arthur Griffith, who was a political opponent, described him as honourable, generous and fearless, and always sincere. Ryan had a clear, uncluttered, logical mind. He was a fine prose writer, luminescent, penetrating, analytic. And when writing at his best, there is an attractive flow and rhythm in his writing. Ryan was a leading thinker and writer of his time, and a fine journalist. But no Irish newspaper of the time would employ him, because of his beliefs and views. One clergyman of the period described him as the most dangerous man in Ireland. Frederick Ryan was a man born before his time. Manus O'Riordan has brought together the principal writings of Fred Ryan in 2 pamphlets, printed in 1984. He tells how he first became acquainted with the man and his work.
Well, my first acquaintance with Frederick Ryan was very limited. When I was researching Connolly's writings in America, I came across an article that Connolly had published in The Harp by Ryan, which was a lecture on the economic future of Ireland. And the name Frederick Ryan was all that struck me. Then that was back in 1970. And at the same time, I read in William O'Brien's memoirs a brief account of Ryan's involvement in the early socialist movement. But it wasn't until about 10 years later that I realised how strong a stand Ryan had taken against one of the most serious prejudices exhibited by Arthur Griffith Sinn Féin, which was anti-Semitism, that the one person to challenge Griffith on his own turf in opposition to the anti-Jewish outbursts in Limerick was Frederick Ryan. And I decided to look into more of Ryan's writings then in the mid-1980s. And the more I read of him, the more he stimulated me, so that I brought out a very limited edition in pamphlet form of those writings that I found most interesting, because he was not only a socialist, he was a humanist. He preached atheism. He preached internationalism. He, as I said, attacked anti-Semitism in Ireland and then went abroad to work for the Egyptian National Movement. He defended Ferrer, who was the Catalonian secular educationist who was executed by a military court-martial in Barcelona in 1909. And there was a whole range of issues where he was a true human spirit, and that fascinated me, that rounded man who had an interest in so many key issues and who was driven by an essential belief in humanity and nothing beyond humanity. But that was more than enough to inspire and stimulate.
The fear of books. There is a phrase of what may be described as the anti-library campaign to which sufficient attention has not been drawn, and which yet throws a light on the real motives which actuate the enemies of the library movement. Monsignor Hallinan, in the now notorious address to the Newcastle West Board of Guardians, a performance which has already secured this country an unenviable notice abroad, dwelt with much solemnity on the dangers to faith and morals which public libraries involved. And this note sounds through the whole propaganda. Monsignor Hallinan talked much of his conscience and his spiritual responsibilities. Having touched this high level, it was somewhat inartistic for the Monsignor to descend to the argument that the people have neither the time nor the craving for much reading, even if the free libraries were to supply them with the most wholesome kind of literature. This is a different line altogether, and even irreconcilable with the first. Since the people have not the craving for reading, nothing is to be done to stimulate it. And whilst faith and morals are supposed to be endangered by a library, they are not, apparently, endangered by the ignorance of people who have not the time or the desire to read. It was a further dissent when Monsignor Hallinan stooped to the argument that there would be leakage in the periodic carting about of books from one school to another. In Rathkeel, I have been informed that very many books are already missing. Evidently, the absence of a library does not mean an absolutely guileless people. Newcastle West, in all its bookless glory, was contrasted with vile places like Dublin and Cork, which possess free libraries, and where even Protestants are tolerated on municipal bodies without bringing about the end of the moral world. Yet spotless Newcastle could not be trusted to remove a few books from place to place without stealing them.
One of his first public involvements was in 1896, when he became a member of the Celtic Literary Society, and then later there was also the ISRP with Connolly. Could you tell us more about these?
Well, my knowledge of his involvement there is rather sketchy. I know that in his obituary, Arthur Griffith referred to his involvement in the Celtic Literary Society and how he was almost won to the nationalist cause espoused by Griffith. But Ryan felt constrained by the narrow nationalism that was being developed by Sinn Féin, and although he wrote for Sinn Féin publications, he reacted against that narrowness. Now, he moved towards socialism and developed a belief in socialism, but also felt constrained by the rather sectarian politics that and factionalism that went on within the Irish Socialist Republican Party, a factionalism which actually drove Connolly himself to escape from that party in 1903 and emigrate to America. Ryan had broader horizons, and I think he was willing to use every opportunity and whatever platform he could set up in order to advance both his socialism and broader democratic issues. And therefore, he was involved in setting up a number of different publications in order to advance those views, while at the same time contributing articles to a whole range of political journals in order to get the same message across. So he was not hamstrung by whatever organisations he may have been part of or even established, as in the case of the later Socialist Party of Ireland, which he founded in 1909.
Mm-hmm. And in 1902, he became the first secretary of the Irish National Theatre Society, which was precursor to the Abbey Theatre. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, this was part of his, if you like, he was very much a universal man, and this was another illustration of that. He was interested in the Irish national revival and the cultural development of Ireland, but reacted against any narrowness in terms of hostility to the English language or hostility to foreign influences. But what he saw happening in the literary revival was an opportunity to put on new plays that actually addressed the themes both of the emerging Ireland as well as the wider international themes. And he contributed one play himself, The Laying of the Foundations, to that theatre, which was highly praised by Yeats at the time, but which unfortunately the manuscript of it, barring the second act, has been lost and was indeed lost during Ryan's own lifetime, so it's actually impossible to reconstruct that play.
Ryan, his friend William Maloney and Thomas Kettle tried to combat orange and green bigotry. They decided to set up a National Democratic Committee led by Michael Davitt to introduce non-sectarian type politics and more secular thinking. Davitt, however, died before the project ever got started. But Ryan and those around him also looked to journals and periodicals to bring some degree of change to the political and intellectual life of the country.
Dana was very interesting from the word go and the manifesto it sort of established, which was the need for free thought and free expression on all themes governing the development of Irish society. It was primarily a literary journal, and it published poems by Padraig Cullum, Oliver St. John Gogarty and indeed James Joyce. But it was a journal which was just as much geared towards the development of critical essays. And in the very first issue of the journal in 1904, Ryan launched an attack against what he regarded as the great sin of Irish politics at that particular time, rival religious bigotries reinforcing each other from the Orange end and from the extreme Catholic end.
The Catholic silence. The fact remains, as Mr. Sinan's article incidentally testifies, that neither the Catholic Church nor any other church has ever encouraged free speech or free inquiry when such could be effectually crushed. The claim that Protestantism did so will not stand examination, the reformers being as ready to persecute those who dissented from them as the Inquisition ever was at its height. All that can be said for Protestantism is that, incidentally and unconsciously, it made for the breakup of vast ecclesiastical systems, and therefore gave greater play to individual freedom. But Calvin treated Servetus just as the Inquisition treated Bruno. The truth is, the philosophy of free inquiry and unfettered speech only began to gain ground when the old dogmas were palpably breaking up. It is a philosophy not even yet by any means accepted in Ireland. It necessitates a broadened and courageous mind. The view, for instance, that a just deity could be no more angered with honest scepticism than an earthly father could be angered with the unintentional mistakes of his children, was a view that only emerged with Diderot and the encyclopedists.
It was around this time, was it not, that Ryan became friendly with Francis Shields Skeffington, who's become a very close friend, and through his desire to set up the National Democratic Committee. Could you tell us something about this?
In the 1906-1907 period in Ireland was a very interesting one, because in contrast to the dominance of religious bigotry on both the nationalist and unionist side, which Ryan railed against in 1904, you had a development on the Protestant Unionist side of the Independent Orange Independent Orange Order under the leadership of Lindsay Crawford, which was extending the hand of friendship to the Catholic community, and particularly brought about by the 1907 strike in Belfast. And in the South, you had Michael Davitt taking up the issue of secular education in opposition to the Bishop O'Dwyer of Limerick at the time, and insisting that we in Ireland not only needed home rule from the point of view of having an independent parliament, but we needed home rule in educational questions. That is, we needed an end to church control over education and to develop a public school system similar to that in the United States. Now, these secular developments on both the unionist and nationalist side inspired Ryan and Skeffington to approach Davitt to set up a National Democratic Committee, of which Davitt would be chairperson. But Davitt, in fact, died just as the venture was about to take off. And what Ryan and Skeffington did was to bring out this newspaper, the National Democrat, which at least made some attempt to further the issues that they had hoped would be part of a broader political program. It did not get beyond the role of being a journal, but it made a further contribution towards spreading a secularist and internationalist view that which job had begun with Diana itself a few years previously.
And as regards Ryan and Skeffington's own political relationship, what did they share in at the time? What did they have in common in politically?
They shared a socialism in common, which was not a Marxist socialism, but it was a view that the socialist movement should embrace people of diverse philosophical positions in order to achieve their common objective. And both Ryan and Skeffington were very much influenced by the evolutionary socialist leader in France, Jean Jaurès. He was, in fact, their mentor from the internationalist point of view. What they also shared was a feeling that in order to progress one's political views in Ireland, one shouldn't pretend to be something other than what one was. In other words, both Ryan and Skeffington were non-believers. They were atheists, or as they themselves would have described it at the time, rationalists or humanists. They argued that case openly and above board, and felt that they could gain greater credibility by being honest about their religious positions. The position was different with Connolly, who, although he hadn't the slightest tincture of religious belief left at the time, as he himself put it, he usually adopted the Catholic pose in public in order to gain greater acceptability for his socialist position. What Ryan and Skeffington also shared, and in this they did share it with Connolly, was a total abhorrence of any development of anti-Semitism on the Irish political scene. And also what they shared was an internationalism which addressed the need to support the progressive developments in other countries, and in order to support the movements for national independence in other countries, which they counterposed very firmly to the Sinn Féin perspective, which in one of its earlier issues had declared that it didn't matter a damn to Ireland whether an earthquake destroyed the West Indies. All we were concerned with in Ireland was Irish affairs, and we shouldn't be bothered with what happens beyond our own shores.
Capitalism and nationalism. A socialist view. In all countries, there are but two distinct classes. The master class owns and controls all the means of production and distribution. The land, the railways, the mills, factories, newspapers, banks, and so forth. And they employ the slave class, at a pittance, to create wealth, giving them in return a fraction of their produce. A smaller fraction, indeed, as circumstances permit. And the slaves may starve, and do starve, as at the time of the Great Famine. If they cannot obtain from one of the master class permission to labour, that is to say, unless one of the master class can see a chance of exploiting them, in Ireland we are too prone to think we are superior to that sort of thing. We think that we have no master class, leading us on any wild goose chase, that we have no slave class, and that we could not be led into absurdities which impose on the English labourer. Yet we watch our master class grow highly indignant at the wrongs committed by England's master class. For example, William Murphy, running his tramway men 12 or 13 hours a day, with one day off in 10, gaily tells us that he is a patriot, that he subscribes to the National Fund and even the Gaelic League.
As you say, in 1909 he returned to Ireland and in the summer helped to revive the Socialist Party of Ireland and became its first secretary. How radical was this party and its aims, and how different was it given the time?
It was rather different from Connolly's first party, the Irish Socialist Republican Party, insofar as it wasn't... It didn't require a common philosophical view as to how socialism should be achieved or what should inspire it. In other words, it was open to all people who believed in socialism, irrespective of their philosophical position. And for that reason, probably had a greater impact on the society. It was Ryan himself who proposed the establishment of the party and became its first national secretary. And the following year, recognising Connolly's importance in the earlier socialist movement, that when Connolly returned to Ireland, it was Ryan proposed that Connolly become a national organiser for that party. But it had a broader appeal, as I say, than the original party, which Ryan had broken with effectively. But Ryan himself, for economic reasons, could not stay involved in it. He had to emigrate in order to earn a living in 1911, and therefore his continuing involvement in Irish socialist politics came to an end following his emigration.
This party, the Social Party of Ireland, came under a lot of attack from certain Catholic newspapers at the time, did it not, from different sources?
Yes. Ryan was always ready to take up the cudgels against priests and other supporters of clericalism who denounced socialism or indeed denounced any sort of democratic development in Irish society at the time, including such a commonplace democratic development as the development of public libraries. But the very same sort of people that Connolly is rightly famous for taking issue with, Father Cain, the Jesuit preacher of Gardiner Street, who denounced socialism and against whom Connolly wrote Labour, Nationality and Religion, this was the same Father Cain that Ryan was also arguing with, and the Father Coleman's and the Father O'Neill's and all those priests who basically wanted to crush any sort of socialist development in Ireland at its very birth. Ryan was more than ready to take issue with them.
The discussion of socialism. A reply to Father Fullerton. It is surely a significant sign of the times that Irish periodicals are devoting more and more attention to the subject of socialism. Dr. Hogan has only just concluded a series of articles in the Irish Ecclesiastical Record on early modern socialists. Now, in the August number of the New Ireland Review, comes Reverend Father Fullerton with an article entitled Socialism, following a series on the social problem. All these articles, it should be, of course, said, are anti-socialist. But even so, the fact of so much criticism being directed to the matter is remarkable. 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, we doubt if such a phenomenon would have occurred. Up to quite recently, socialism was looked upon in Ireland as some weird, diabolical possession, a strange and fantastic heresy that had somehow perverted a few continental miscreants. Father Fullerton confesses that it is not surprising that socialism should incite interest and enthusiasm. He describes in his own words some of the socialists' ideals. There are to be no more workhouses, no more slums, no more poverty, no more palaces. All must work for a living, but wages will be increased and working hours shortened, and from a uniform distribution of wealth, all will be equally rich, equally prosperous, equally happy. Surely, even thus put, it is not an ignoble, scarcely an unchristian ideal. Every citizen, irrespective of birth or position, writes Father Fullerton, will be compelled to work for his living. He will be paid enough to keep himself decently and comfortably, and perhaps, if he is economic, to save a little, which little, however, he cannot invest or trade with in any way except in procuring from the state what the state may be willing to sell to him. One fails from all this to derive the impression of unspeakable horror which anti-socialists often desire to produce in speaking of socialist proposals.
And he also wrote a lot about the nationalist movement at the time and criticised their vision of Ireland and their vision of Ireland post-independence.
Yes, Ryan was against isolationism. He believed in the necessity for Irish independence, but he believed in it in order that it provided the best means for the development of a self-reliant moral society in Ireland, a free development of that society. And he went beyond that because he said that that same principle also applied east of Suez. That was why he was as much interested in the development of the national movement in Persia and its struggles as the national movement in Egypt or the national movement in Ireland itself. And of course, it was for that internationalism that Arthur Griffith in particular condemned him. But as far as he was concerned, you needed that depth of vision. That's what humanity was all about. And he felt that the key issue in Ireland, as the key issue internationally, was the social issue, that you had an economic system which kept people in grinding poverty, and you could have no human development, whether on the basis of national independence or otherwise, without tackling that social question. And again, his principle was internationalist. He said, the cry of agony and poverty that goes up from St. Petersburg or Berlin is answered by a companion cry from those who live under the very shadow of the White House. and that mattered as much to him as tackling poverty within Ireland itself and fighting for a better social system to replace capitalist exploitation in Ireland.
He also questioned the pervading definitions in the Gaelic League of real Irishness, which is speaking Irish. And would you say this has resonances today in the GAA or speaking Irish and then being Catholic also?
From my own point of view, I don't fully agree with Ryan on that particular issue. I think he probably overstated it in reaction against the bigotry that was shown by a lot of the Gaelic movement, because he quoted Father Dineen, the compiler of the Irish-English dictionary, as saying that if we had our own Irish language, we wouldn't be so amenable to the bad influences that came through English literature. And it was that parochialism he attacked. I think he perhaps went a bit overboard in reducing the question of the Irish language to a purely educational issue, that he welcomed its development in Irish universities and he welcomed the spread of learning that was associated with it. I think he went overboard in his reaction against the attempt to revive the Irish language, precisely because it wasn't a question of reviving the Irish language that at least the Gaelic League was setting itself as an objective at that stage. It was the replacement of the English language by Irish, and it was that replacement that he reacted against. But he reacted against it in a very dignified way. His exchange of views and his criticisms of what he regarded on the other side as well-argued positions developed by Patrick Pearce were based on respect for people like Pearce, although he had less respect, as I say, for the bigotry shown by Father Dineen. But he in turn was held in respect by the Gaelic movement, because the Gaelic revival movement, as part of its entertainment, and as one of its concerts, actually put on a production of his play, The Laying of the Foundations, while knowing precisely his views on that movement. So he was a man capable, despite the intensity of polemic in so many of his arguments, he was a man capable of earning the respect of his political enemies in that regard.
On language and political ideals. A reply to P.H. Pearce. As was perhaps to be expected, I have been favoured with several criticisms of my article on the Gaelic League, published in the November number of this review. And though one critic wondered how I could have fallen into the obvious error of regarding the League as popular, it is yet the fact that all the comments I have seen are pro-Gaelic League. Before, however, dealing with any, let me explain a point which Mr. Gwynn and the editor of An Clive Sulish, P.H. Pearce, have both somewhat misunderstood. When I commented on the fact that the Gaelic League was praised by opposite types of politicians and publicists. And when, therefore, Cardinal Logue, for instance, supports the League because it will tend to make Ireland less amenable to modern thought, and Sir Horace Plunkett supports it because it will strengthen modern influences. Either or both must be miscalculating. The League may possibly have no effect on the matter, but it cannot have both of two opposite effects. If one man tells me he thinks that the speaking of Gaelic will reconcile Ireland to the Empire by stimulating a local patriotism which does not necessarily clash with imperial interests, and another tells me he supports it because the speaking of Irish will further the desire of Irish independence, then one or other must be wrong.
At the turn of the century, there was a small community of Jews in Limerick. In January 1904, Father John Cray, a Redemptorist priest in the city, preached a number of anti-Semitic sermons. These led directly to physical attacks on Jews, to damage and destruction of their property, and to an organised boycott. Ryan condemned unequivocally the anti-Semitic outbreak in Limerick. Arthur Griffith, the leader of Sinn Féin, on the other hand, said that the attacks resulted from unacceptable trading practices by the Jews and were not in themselves anti-Semitic.
He was the one person to tackle Griffith on his home turf. I think the best known critic of the Limerick anti-Semitism of 1904 was Michael Davitt. When in a sense, Michael Davitt was criticising Limerick anti-Semitism from the position of somebody who was an Irish representative in the British House of Commons. There was that degree of detachment from the maelstrom, if you like, of domestic Irish politics. Ryan was the man who took issue with Griffith in Griffith's own newspaper in denouncing anti-Semitism as being part of a tradition of Christendom in scapegoating Jewish people, and as being the worst element of continental European reactionary politics, which for all Griffith's protestation about being only out for a development of Irish politics, Griffith was actually importing the European anti-Semitism that was manifesting itself in Hungarian nationalist politics and the nationalist politics of a number of other European countries. Ryan took on Griffith, as I say, on his home patch, and probably earned Griffith's respect in that regard, even though Griffith resolutely stuck to his own prejudices in that particular contest.
Against the anti-Semitism of Arthur Griffith. You say that if the Jews as Jews were boycotted, it would be outrageously unjust, but that I am labouring under an obvious misapprehension. The Jew in Limerick, you say, has not been boycotted because he is a Jew, but because he is a usurer. Now I respectfully submit that it is you who are under a misapprehension as to the beginning of this affair. The Limerick disturbances distinctly began in an incitement against Jews as Jews, in the first speech of the courageous Father Cray, of whom you are surprised the Jewish rabbi should speak impolitely, occurred passages like this. They, the Jews, slew St. Stephen the first martyr, and St. James the apostle, and ever since, as often as opportunity offered, they did not hesitate to shed Christian blood, and that even in the meanest and most cruel manner, as in the case of the holy martyr St. Simeon, who, though a mere child, they took and crucified out of hatred and derision towards our Lord Jesus Christ. Nowadays, they dare not kidnap and slay Christian children, but they will not hesitate to expose them to a longer and more cruel martyrdom by taking the clothes off their back and the bit out of their mouth.
Ryan was also very modern, was he not, in his attitude to foreign affairs, which you mentioned earlier. He craved a less reactionary and more understanding attitude to the outside world, and a good example of this would be the case of Ferrer in Spain. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, this was another issue on which Ryan took issue with Sinn Féin and with Griffith's hostility towards any interest in what was happening abroad, as distinct from what Griffith himself borrowed, such as anti-Semitism. But the case of Ferrer in Barcelona, Ryan particularly identified with. Ferrer was a secular educationalist in Barcelona, and in 1909, there was rioting in Barcelona against a Spanish war in North Africa, rioting which took the form on the part of some parts of the crowd setting fire to churches. Now, Ferrer was scapegoated for that, even though he had no involvement in that particular outburst. Ferrer was not, in fact, involved in activist politics at all. He was involved in the development of secular education and non-denominational education, but he was not involved in any physical force movement. But there was such a reaction from the Spanish military authorities to the church burning that had taken place that they scapegoated Ferrer as a secularist, put him on trial, put him before a court martial. It wasn't a proper trial because no witnesses were called, and summarily executed him. Griffith and Griffith's Sinn Féin newspaper denounced British media attention on this miscarriage of justice. Ryan took up the case of Ferrer.
A fortnight or so ago, Señor Ferrer, known as a Spanish educational reformer, who had founded a number of modern schools in Catalonia, was charged before a court-martial with having participated in the Barcelona disturbances a few months ago. He denied the charge and protested his innocence. No witnesses, however, were personally examined before the court-martial. Their depositions were only read. No cross-examination or testing of the credibility of the witnesses was therefore possible. Documents alleged to have been found in Ferrer's house, he declared he had never seen before, the presumption being that they had been concocted by police agents. We in Ireland at least know enough of these things to appreciate the allegations. Ferrer had admittedly excited the hostility of the clerical and conservative parties in Spain, since he believed, like Michael Davitt, in secular education, and had published a series of manuals and textbooks for his schools, many of them being translations of the textbooks of modern French and German scientists. On the evidence thus presented, the court-martial found Ferrer guilty, sentenced him to death, and he was shot a couple of days afterwards.
For the last 2 years of his life, approximately from 1911 to 13, he went to London and edited Egypt for Wilfred Scawn Blunt, up until his death, in Blunt's house in April of 13. Could you take us through this period up to his death of appendicitis in April of 13?
Well, for economic reasons, again, he had been forced to emigrate from Ireland. He couldn't earn a living as a journalist here, quite obviously because of his views. He was such a self-sacrificing man that, in fact, his own personal welfare he thought very little of. It was he who insisted on looking after the personal welfare of Connolly when Connolly came back to Ireland in 1909 to be the national organiser for the Socialist Party of Ireland, because Ryan, seeing that Connolly had a family to support, realised that Connolly needed a steady wage, and it was through Ryan that Connolly, in fact, got employed as an organiser also for the Irish Transport and General Workers' Union, of which he became acting general secretary following Larkin's departure. But so anxious to look after the welfare of others, he didn't look too well after his own, and yet couldn't continue living off his own family when he couldn't find employment here. So he did find employment through Blunt in England in editing a new publication called Egypt, which not only addressed the need to make the case for Egyptian national independence known to British public opinion, but also brought to the attention of the British public the national movements in Persia and other developments in the Middle East, where there was a growing national movement, which was very little understood in Britain at that time and only became understood in a sort of romantic fashion after the First World War and Lawrence of Arabia's involvement in it. Ryan worked ceaselessly on behalf of that particular publication up to the point of his death. And because Blunt had been so reliant on Ryan, the work actually could not continue after Ryan's death. Ryan was the linchpin of that particular propaganda campaign on behalf of the Egyptian national movement. Again, thinking so little of himself, Ryan had actually spent that particular Easter in Paris showing some of his members of his family, nephews and nieces around Paris. And even though he had been complaining of ill health, refused to see a doctor. So it was only after he had discharged that particular family duty and was visiting Blunt in Blunt's home that he called for a doctor. It was discovered he had appendicitis, but by that stage it was too far advanced, and he died within a couple of days of the operation. So his death to everybody came as a great surprise, precisely because he had been such an uncomplaining and self-sacrificing individual right up to that very point.
Wilfred Scawn Blunt was, amongst other things, a diarist. This is his entry for the 9th of April, 1913. All is over. The funeral left our door at 1:30. One thing is certain. It's useless continuing our paper, in any form, without Ryan.
Mr. Frederick Ryan, a well-known Irish journalist, died on Monday night at South Water, Horsham, Sussex, the residence of Mr. W.S. Blunt. Mr. Ryan, who was the eldest son of the late John A. Ryan, 145 Great Brunswick Street, was only 39 years of age. For many years, he was prominently identified with the advanced nationalist movement in his native city.
Jim Larkin penned an obituary for him, which was, in characteristic Larkin style, blunt and to the point. We've lost a man and a journalist. And Francis Sheehy Skeffington, in particular, felt a great sense of loss. And it was that drive towards advancing and deepening the common humanity that he saw before him, both in Ireland and elsewhere, that was, in fact, the ethical principle underlying the activities of Frederick Ryan's life. And it is for that reason that Skeffington put it very succinctly in his obituary when he said, "One of Fred Ryan's favourite themes was the needlessness of any religious sanction to produce the highest type of character. Of this truth, he himself was an outstanding illustration. He might well be called the saint of Irish rationalism." It was Ryan himself who had argued that the most spiritual work today in Ireland is material. "Roses and lilies do not usually grow in stagnant pools," he said. "Neither then can the roses and lilies of human character be expected to flourish in a slum where the poverty is often so great that it pulls down and degrades. We must have healthy material surroundings before we can hope to have moral and spiritual flowers."
Mr. Ryan was one of the clearest thinkers and ablest writers in the Irish journalistic world. An advanced feminist, socialist and nationalist, he was an active worker in every movement of the revolutionary aim or temper, religious, literary or political, in Dublin for the past 15 or 20 years. He was a man of an exceptionally gentle and lovable disposition, and in spite of the strong opinions which he held and his fearlessness in expressing them, he had no enemies. His last public appearance in Dublin was on a suffragist platform on January 7th, when he delivered a lecture to the Irish Women's Franchise League, of which he was an associate, on the awakening of women in the East. He specially postponed his return to London, where he edited Egypt, for the purpose of delivering this address. In his death, Ireland has lost a high-minded patriot, countless reforming movements have lost a fountain of inspiring ideas, and the conductors of the Irish citizen miss a much-loved personal friend.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.